Various polls show that even the educated general public doesn't know basic facts about the structure of the U.S. government, the Constitution, the rights of states, and the division of powers. Yet there is a widespread acceptance of the greatness and goodness of the United States, along with the extreme mistrust of government, except for the military.
You're listening to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, An Indigenous People's History. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can get CDs of this program and her book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, by calling us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. We can go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977.
A recent tiny Associated Press story provided polling information of U.S. American public regarding their confidence in federal government institutions, reporting only 6% have confidence in Congress. 14% of people said they have confidence in the executive branch, which includes the president and all of the cabinet agencies. 24% say they have confidence in the Supreme Court. However, 84% have confidence in the military. The military is the only unifying government institution, the only one trusted. So we have to understand where that military has come from and what it is. Why is there so little information, analysis, or curiosity in the origins and development of the U.S. military? In history and political science texts, doesn't exist. And teaching at any grade level, graduate school, the military history field, small as it is usually made up of warmongers and former military people and people who certainly never write about what actually happened to form that military. The military isn't even presented as a branch of government, as we know there are only three branches of government. Rather is placed under the formally civilian elected president and commander-in-chief of the armed forces. This is meant to scare you because Trump isn't just president. He's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. And as he said, I heard him on TV tonight say that he can do anything he wants because he's that. However, from the earliest settlements in the 1600s to the adhesion of the 13 British colonies into an independent nation state and up to the present, the military has been the engine that drives U.S. nationalism, that is, patriotism. Yet generations have little knowledge of interaction with the military. But the annals of military history reveal the architecture of its formation and function and dominance. Air Force officer and military historian John Grenier gives me hope that this hopefully is beginning to change, writes, "For the first 200 years of our military heritage, Americans depended on arts of war that contemporary professional soldiers at that time supposedly abhorred, razing and destroying enemy villages and fields," read Native American, "killing enemy women and children, raiding settlements for captives, intimidating and brutalizing enemy noncombatants, and assassinating enemy leaders. In the frontier wars between 1607 and 1814, Americans forged two elements, unlimited war and irregular war, into their first way of war." So from this period, Grenier argues, emerge the problematic characteristics of the U.S. way of war, and thereby the characteristics of U.S. civilization, which few civilian historians or even anti-war activists acknowledge. Here's an example of the matrix that is deconstructed when a thread from the weave of consensus U.S. history is pulled, and why the public discussion of Confederate fetishism provides a teachable moment. In July 2015, the California State Legislature's Black Caucus, I live in California, called on state authorities to change the name of the town of Fort Bragg, California, the site of a former military base 170 miles north of San Francisco, now just a town by that name, because it was named after Confederate General Braxton Bragg. Who knew there was a Confederate general name on an army base or a former army base, a town in California? In the course of his long military career, Bragg, an 1837 West Point graduate, was commander of the Confederate Army in the Civil War and owned a plantation and over 100 enslaved Africans. But that's only half the story of General Bragg's career, as it is of most of the Confederate as well as Union military commanders. The Black Caucus rightly raised the issue in the wake of the June 17, 2015 Charleston, South Carolina assassination of senior pastor and state senator Clementa C. Pinckney, along with eight worshipers at the oldest historical Black church in North America, Mother Emmanuel, which had been founded by Denmark Vesey, a formerly enslaved African, a carpenter by trade who purchased his freedom, and later organized a failed slave revolt for which he and a dozen other insurgents were hung. This event happened on that date of the hanging of Denmark Vesey. Shocked attention to the church massacre quickly turned to the continued presence of the Confederate flag on the South Carolina State House in Charleston, the assassin being a self-identified white supremacist whose internet photos showed him toting the Confederate flag. A national debate ensued, not only about the proliferation of Confederate flags throughout the South and in white supremacist enclaves and at gun shows all over the country, but also public monuments and place names, particularly army bases named after Confederate officers. There are, in fact, 9 other U.S. military bases in addition to Fort Bragg that are named after Confederate officers, most of them in the South. But Fort Bragg reveals a more complex history. Few in California knew that their state hosted a base, now a town, named after a Confederate general. But the argument began immediately. Those who objected to changing the name, especially the people living in Fort Bragg, there aren't many there, pointed out that General Bragg was a decorated U.S. Army officer in 1857, 3 years before the founding of the Confederacy, when Fort Bragg was built and named. That's certainly different from those bases in the South named after Confederates, all of which occurred in the post-Civil War Jim Crow segregationist era of the early and up to the mid-20th century. In Bragg's case, the naming honor recalled his actions as a captain serving under Major General Zachary Taylor in the United States Army and Marine invasion and occupation of Mexico City in 1847, forcing the Mexican Republic to cede the northern half of its territory. And the purpose of establishing Fort Bragg a decade later, in 1857, to carry out the confinement of indigenous Californians rounded up and forced into the newly established Mendocino Indian Reservation, where a military base was also established and named after Bragg, all before the Civil War. The Black Caucus statement asserted that it was inappropriate to honor an individual who committed treason against the United States in defense of slavery. Nearly everyone who has argued for the change of names of military bases has invoked treason. Yet all of the West Point graduate officers who led the Confederacy, after whom the bases are named, has been honorably recognized for their feats in the invasion and brutal counterinsurgency over a two-year period of Mexico, occupying and terrorizing the civilian population in Mexico City until the government officials with guns at their heads signed a treaty of cession, including Robert E. Lee and several others who served and led the U.S. war against the Seminole Nation in Florida. There were three U.S. wars against the Seminole Nation over the period of 1816 to 1858, all of them counterinsurgent, irregular wars, and all led by West Point graduates, who then, in the later years, became either Union or Confederate soldiers. But it seems it would have been appropriate had these officers not chosen the Confederate side and stayed in the U.S. Army to slaughter Native Americans during and after the Civil War, like nearly every military officer of the Union Army. Sherman, Fremont, Grant, Custer, to name the most famous of the Union officers who later formed the leadership of the so-called Army of the West. In fact, the majority of U.S. Army bases on the continent were initially outposts for wars against indigenous nations: Fort Snelling, Hays, Kearney, Leavenworth, Sill, and Riley, the latter the base of George Armstrong Custer's 7th Cavalry, now the 1st Infantry Division, all named after U.S. Army officers who commanded genocidal wars. For most of the period from the U.S. War of Independence to 1890s, the sole function of the U.S. military was to kill, round up refugees, relocate and confine Native Americans, and appropriate their land and resources to replace with Anglo-American settlers, and sometimes from other countries like Scandinavians, particularly slave-owning planters involved in monocash production. Got most of that land. The Army officers of both the Confederacy and the Union had made their careers in genocidal campaigns against Native nations and against the indigenous and mestizo peoples of Mexico, which included where we are now, annexing half its territory, and including three major declared wars against the Seminole Nation before the Civil War. Both Union and Confederate armies posted regiments west of the Mississippi to invade territories of the Dakota, Cheyenne, Navajo, Apache, and Comanche nations, among others. Wars against the Native peoples did not miss a beat during the Civil War, which saw the military rounding up and deporting the entire Navajo population that Kit Carson could round up to a desert concentration camp where one-third succumbed to starvation, exposure, and disease. And the ethnic cleansing of the Dakota people in their traditional territory in Minnesota to be replaced by Scandinavian settlers. After the Civil War, when the U.S. Army was supposed to prioritize occupation of the defeated Confederate states, forcing a reconstruction in which liberated African Americans could become participating and leading citizens, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, the president, kept shifting armed forces from the South to the West, where a 25-year total war was waged to destroy the Native nations in the Northern Plains, the Intermountain West, and the Southwest. The United States is a thoroughly militarized culture, all the more dangerous because we don't know it. It's subliminal. And it has been since its bloody birth, the blood being mainly that of indigenous peoples in the path of the colonists' relentless expansion during that revolution, their Revolutionary War. We see the signs of militarism all around us and in the media. But as military historian John Grenier notes, the cultural aspect of militarization are not new. They have deep historical roots reaching into the nation's racist settler past and continuing through unrelenting wars of conquest and ethnic cleansing over three centuries. Grenier writes, beyond its sheer military utility, Americans also found a use for the First Wave War in the construction of American identity. The enduring appeal of the romanticized myth of the settlement, in quotes, not calling it conquest, of the frontier, either by actual men like Robert Rogers or Daniel Boone, or fictitious ones like Nathaniel Bumppo of James Fenimore Cooper's creation, Last of the Mohegans. It all points to what D.H. Lawrence called the myth of the essential white American. U.S. nationalism, its national narrative and origin story, is white nationalism. And any historical analysis or current social crisis cannot be comprehended without acknowledging U.S. settler colonialism and colonial violence, centering indigenous America historically and in the present. So I thank you.
That was Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, An Indigenous People's History. I had a chance to ask her a few questions. Talk about the resistance at Standing Rock. What do you think happened there and its significance?
Yeah, you have to remember this is in a tradition of Standing Rock and the Lakota of resistance. It's a continuation. These things have been going on all this time. It's that this particular moment caught attention for various reasons, but I think mainly, you know, the toxic atmosphere created by the Trump campaign, that people looked at it, especially people, liberals and on the left, and anyone who was doing social justice work, the churches and all, as such a breath of fresh air. There's something positive happening. Here are people fighting for their lives and standing up. And so it just became this amazing pilgrimage, you might say. But what was important is that for the first time in any kind of environmental thing, they always want Native people to be involved and be out front as the poster children for raising money for Bill McKibben's outfit and all these things. And, you know, the Indigenous Environmental Network, they're willing to, you know, have these collaborations. But this is the first time where the Native people were in charge. And it was on Indian land and one of the most militant Native American reservations in the country, the Standing Rock Sioux. This is where Sitting Bull is buried. This is where really Wounded Knee, 1973, they first met at Standing Rock, and the American Indian Movement formed the International Indian Treaty Council at Standing Rock. So Standing Rock is also the place where the refugees from the Dakota Wars, you know, during the Civil War, the utter genocide of Lincoln administration against the Dakotas in Minnesota, they took refuge at Standing Rock. So these militant Dakotas, you know, it's a mixture of basically resistors and their families. Some people who didn't know anything about Native resistance thought it was the first time of anything, first time Native Americans have ever risen up on their own and gotten together. I mean, they have, you know, the National Council of American Indians, the All Indian Pueblo Council, and they get together all the time, but this is all kind of subterranean to the general public. So it really became a positive thing in the media. Alcatraz had pretty positive image, but Wounded Knee was attacked by the press. European press was very positive about the Wounded Knee 1973, but Nixon, you know, really had such control on the press when he was president. So it was a lot of negative. And still to this day, there's a lot of negative misinformation about Wounded Knee and the American Indian Movement.
But these people, again, women were very much in the leadership there. I remember one clip I saw on TV. I don't know if it was Democracy Now! Or MSNBC was doing really good coverage. But they put a microphone up, Bill McKibben, and he got all puffed up to do his talk. And Tara Huska, this wonderful native lawyer, a Coast Salish from the Northwest, just gently took the microphone. And, you know, they just took leadership. And, of course, David Archambault, who comes from a very militant, historically militant family, the Archambaults. He was a young, you know, the young tribal chairman, limited by his role as the Indian Reorganization Act, federal, at least with his, you know, counsel, because the president or the chairman in these IRA governments do not have a lot of executive authority. They have to have the council, and the council is, you know, more conservative at Wounded Knee. But it was amazing how courageous he went beyond the usual bounds of what a tribal chairman can do, and how all the tribal chairmen from all across the country came and set up camps there. So there was a whole diplomatic camp. My conversant at the Landon Forum, Nick Estes, helped organize the diplomatic camps there, was kind of the main person organizing them. And you saw pictures of all the flags, I'm sure, you know, the flags of different Native nations and all. So it was amazing, too, that Veterans for Peace and other Vietnam War vets and other vets, Iraq vets against the war, Afghan vets, that they came to 5,000 of them. They put out a call, and they had to stop it. They said, no more. You know, they had no idea that more than a few hundred would come. And Wesley Clark Jr., of course, did this ceremony of dressing up like Custer and getting on his knees and apologizing to what were the old AIM people, Leonard Crowdog and Phyllis Young. And that was the most beautiful scene and very moving. And, of course, they were there in this terrible snowstorm, you know, and blinding storm. It has lasting effects. Before, you know, it got police brutality began and mercenaries and dogs and all that. It had from April to October as this well-known but not so publicized where people were making pilgrimages there. I know at least three different teachers in Chicago that took their summer inner city program with young people, and it changed their lives, camping out there. And Nick arranged for them, one of them that I had recommended, to be in the diplomatic camp. They all went completely self-sufficient. Everyone who went there was so, there are no resources here. It's hard for people to believe, but, you know, you have to drive 40 miles to a grocery store, and of course, winter's coming. So everyone who came fully prepared. There was a book drive, you know, and they got so many books from authors and publishers that they had no way of assimilating their library.
But can that movement be built upon? Can it expand?
Well, I think it affected tens of thousands of people directly, you know, who went there, because at any one time there were 10 to 20,000 people there, but hundreds of thousands in all. Some people visited for a day or two or three. Everyone, you know, came back and they formed local groups. A lot of the stuff is in the courts now, so they do demonstrations in front of courts and all. But I think more than anything, once it becomes clear that there's Indian land and Indian people out there still, to people, it becomes real, and they've met these people. They've hugged them. They've shaken hands with them. They've shared food with them. It transforms people because they can't unknow what they know once they're taught, and they learned a lot of things there, just as I was talking about how I learned. I had so many experiences like that where it's accelerated your learning process, you know, because once your mind is open to it, it's just endless and you can't really go back. So I think that's the most important thing in the long term as we form a future movement and a future vision of what the future might be like.
You were just listening to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, An Indigenous People's History. She spoke in Santa Fe, New Mexico in 2017. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz is a distinguished scholar and activist. She's the author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States, winner of the American Book Award. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and in our 35th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such progressive voices as Winona LaDuke, Noam Chomsky, Arundhati Roy, Jeffrey Robinson, Angela Davis, and Michael Eric Dyson. And we have a series of programs with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz and for her award-winning book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the Lanham Foundation. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with John Trudell, Blue Indians.
Stranded persons search for meaning. Storykeepers run out of bandages. Histories washed in ritual blood. Traditions bleed in high-tech flood. Workers, not serfs. Terminologies change. Progress as evolution, terminal strange. Blue Indians being pulled into melting pots. Grueling class rules the haves and have-nots. Industrial reservation, tyranny stakes its claim. Blue Indians, emotional siege in civilized stain.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SF Youth Community Radio Station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
This is Bird Note. From house wrens to wild turkeys, birds of all sizes like to scrub themselves clean using dirt? Call it what you will. Dirt bathing, dust bathing, or dusting, it's part of a bird's self-care routine, especially during summer. Birds may take a dirt bath alone, in pairs, or in a flock, and they'll chase away other birds from their favorite patch. Typically, a bird shuffles its feet to scrape a depression in the ground. Sitting on its belly with feathers ruffled, it flicks dirt onto its body. Now, a nice rub of the neck in the dust, and then a good shimmy gets rid of it all. Individuals may peck at the dirt to loosen it before or during the bath, which could last anywhere from a few seconds to several minutes. Experiments showed that frolicking in the dirt is good for a bird's plumage. When access to dirt was cut off for the northern bobwhite, oil started building up on its feathers. After Japanese quails dusted for about 2 weeks, they had less dandruff. In other words, dirt is like shampoo for birds. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.